Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Torah portion of Shemini, which means eighth, and covers Leviticus chapter 9 through 11. And also we picked up parallel passages there in 2 Samuel chapter 6 through verse 17 of chapter 7, and Acts chapter 10, and a section there from Hebrews chapter 7. And then we took a look at, for the Shabbat HaKodesh, passages there about the first month. They're talking about the first month of the year in Exodus chapter 12. And then we saw an interesting passage there that we were taking a look at from Ezekiel. A very, very fascinating picture that we look at from Ezekiel, because we're seeing there a very interesting thing that ties into what we just read in Hebrews chapter 7. I'm wondering if you happen to have caught it. Hebrews chapter 7. One of those interesting passages there where it talks about change of the priesthood being a change in the law. You notice that the description in Ezekiel is a bit different than what we've seen in the Torah related to how the temple operates. We mentioned this a few weeks ago. How many gates are there? Three. There's three gates to this particular temple. Now, the city, we get the picture of the city of New Jerusalem. Yes, 12. And talking about the gates into the city related to the apostles, 12 apostles. And then upon the 12 patriarchs, we got the foundations of the city. The temple itself has three gates. And a very interesting picture that you see. Did you see the description, you might say, of your flow plan? When people always talk about logistics for an event, they always talk about the flow. How is the flow going to go? Well, what is the flow of this temple that's described? There's three gates. What happens to the gate on the east? That's the one where the Nasi, or the prince, goes in and out of. What about the one on the north and the south? Those are where the peoples come in. But it's interesting how it describes that flow. You come in, if you come in through the north gate, you go out through the south gate. If you come in through the south gate, you go out through the north gate. And if you remember the some of the various renditions that people have done on Ezekiel's temple, it's like a square, but it looks like a flow through from the, especially north and south, and from the east gate. They allow this flow through where the center is upon what? Upon altar. And it's very interesting is that the, what do you see as far as the way of the layout of the temple? Altar is one thing we might recognize from the way that we have the description there in the Torah. But what about the holy place and the most holy place? Where is it? Interesting. One of the things that's talked about in the descriptions of the temple, as you go out and you start in, back in chapter 40 of Ezekiel, as it starts describing this, where's the holy place of this temple? Quite expanded, isn't it? It's the entire mountain that it sits on. The whole thing is the holy place, which is a very interesting picture of where this is talking about, because where is this temple going to show up? Around the time of the day of the Lord, where you're having this vision that he has of the temple. This is talking about the time period of the day of the Lord. So, you're seeing here a very interesting picture of a situation that has changed. Remember when we started into the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, we have this picture of the tabernacle, and it is about, you could say, concentric circles, or in this case, squares and rectangles of holiness or separations. On the outside, you have where the people are dwelling, all of the tribes dwelling around the tabernacle. But you have then the tribes of Levi kind of in the closest proximity to it. And what was their job, the various tribes were? To be a buffer for the people, to just prevent them from just coming on in. But then you have the courtyard itself. That was also to just prevent the people from coming on in any way they felt like. There was only in the tabernacle and then the later temple that we just read about there in 2 Samuel that was going to get commissioned. There was only one door in that one, in the tabernacle and in the temple. There was only one door. Speaking of doors, yes. So one of the things that we have about the tabernacle temple is that it is meant to emphasize that there is the world and then there is the creator in the world, and that the creator wants to dwell in the midst of the people, but the people need to be transformed. And one of the things that you see starting from the verse chapter of Vayikra, Leviticus chapter 1, and we talked about this in our last time around, our last Torah reading, is that it's a very interesting picture that we have about that the when you bring the offerings of various types in, you are to lean in or lean on your offering. You are to like put a laying on of hands. And it's a very interesting picture is that when you see some of the various commentators that have reflected on this over the centuries, it says, you shall put your hand on it. But then when you get to Leviticus 16, we'll see that on our next couple of portions away, when we get to that particular portion of Acharemot, we will see that Aharon is to put both hands onto the top of it. And a reflection that's put on it is that you don't just put a hand on it because you can get a representative to do that for you, a stand-in. You can have an attorney that will put their hands on something. But if you put both of your hands on it, you yourself are leaning on it. And as it talks about in chapter 1 of Leviticus, you know, you are leaning on it and basically transferring yourself to your offering, to the korban. And the korban, the thing that approaches, then approaches ahead of you, goes to the altar, and then proceeds on. It dies, and the various offerings get offered up in various ways. So when we see this picture in when our readings here today, when we're looking at Leviticus chapter 10, I've got this drawing here from the late 1800s, somebody's rendition. They render Nadab and Abihu as kids, but we don't exactly know for sure, but your picture of a priest is how old would they be? Yeah, they're at least 30. So, thus, not likely kids, but all right, so they were young. But they came in, and we mentioned it when we were there in the latter chapters of Exodus. But where were these two sons of Aharon? They're in a special meeting with the glory of the Lord up on the mountain when the elders had a meal with the Lord there up on the mountain. So here you have later on, they have another encounter with the Lord. And it says, here it just describes in chapter 10 that they took their fire pans or their censers. You know, you think of in some liturgical congregations. They still use censers and they ornate and whatever, but it's a similar idea. You have some sort of thing where you have coal in it or something that's burning, and then that's where you hold the coal, and then for a fragrant censer, then you put something nice smelling on top of it. And we saw earlier what those combinations of the spices and aromatics are that go into this, a very special, special combination. And what was the instruction that the Lord had for this special combination of incense? Nobody else is to copy it. This is not to be franchised. You're not going to be mass producing this particular fragrance, you know. The tabernacle, yes. It's not going to be the special essence of the tabernacle. Why? Because it's to be different, separate, and we call that holy. It's to be kadosh, separate from everything of the world. And when you smell it, you are to think of what? Only one place and one function, not something else and something different. So one of the things that keeps getting emphasized again and again of in the book of Vayikra is about separation. But it's a very interesting paradox, because we see in Exodus, build this tabernacle so the Lord can do what? Dwell in it where? Amongst his people. So you have this weird tension going on here between separateness and inclusion and wanting to dwell among, so wanting to be in the midst of them, but needing to keep things separate. So emphasizing that the things that go on outside of the walls of the tabernacle are not to be just dragged in to what's happening inside. And then you'll see when we get into the book of Devarim or Deuteronomy, that you'll see the instructions go, hey, you see practices going out there about how they worship in their temples? Don't drag that in to the Lord's house either. Don't take those practices out there and do them in the tabernacle of the Lord. Why? Because the Lord is not like one of these other so-called deities. You're talking about the creator of heaven and earth. These other so-called entities, they're either so-called, false, or wannabes. Yes, not the creator. So when we look at this, we get some in different lessons that we have about Shemini, about especially chapter 11, when we get into the clean and unclean foods. One of the things that we have in as we start into these, as we'll see in the next few chapters after this particular passage of Shemini, we'll see more of these distinctions between clean and unclean, clean and unclean. So one of the lessons we have that's very similar to the construction of the tabernacle itself is, you know, watch out for the things that heaven says make one fit to approach the presence of God and unfit to approach the presence of God. But we'll notice as we continue on with the book of Vayikra, Leviticus, that some of these things are just completely out of our control. They're things that happen because we're human and bodily processes that men have, that women have. It just happens. That is life in this world. So those things will make us fit to approach, unfit to approach. But the point is in the lesson of life versus death. That's one thing that's emphasized a lot between the kingdom of life, that's what's in the tabernacle, that's in the presence of God, and the kingdom of death, which is outside, decay, disease, things going wrong. Yes, Anne, you have a comment or a question over here?
Yes, this reminds me of a section that was read about some of the creatures that are unclean are called despised And they use the word despise. Michael, the daughter of Saul, was David's wife, and she despised her husband because he was dancing with a loincloth on. And so she despised him in her heart. So I'm thinking of the two words used. One is despised because of being an unclean animal, and the other thing is David being unclean because he's dancing before the Lord. So that it's kind of a strange word that despise came in there, you know, between unclean and clean. And I don't know how you can.
Yeah, well, one is talking about a rejection of it. It's like it cannot be in the same presence, and the other one is loathing. So yeah, it may be using the same English word, but you have the sense that one is talking about not really fit to be in the presence of, like a stench sort of thing, and the other one being a loathing, just like, oh, looking down. You can also say demeaning upon somebody. So in that sense, you'll see as that account that we saw in 2 Samuel goes on, that it's really about that he took off the clothes. And you get this depiction that he was like, you know, disrobed. No. Put on ephod, which is quite different than just being completely disrobed down there. But the point was, what did he take off? His kingly robes that emphasize he is king above everybody else. Well, what did he do? He put on an ephod. So that's basically what looked like a priest. So he's looking like one of everybody, the other servants. He wasn't a head above everybody, and he's out dancing around. Is that the attitude or the presence of a king? No, it's a herald. That's what heralds do. I'm going to talk about people going in with singing and dancing and that kind of thing. That's what a herald of somebody else does, not the grand poobah himself. So he was lowering his status in being out there, because in that attitude, who was he praising? He was praising the Lord in that sense. The praise was going toward the Creator, and it wasn't going to himself as being, I am out here with my priestly robes here, or my kingly robes, I should say. So that being a key distinction of it, being in the presence of the Lord, but not being the attention of it, being the attention of what is going on. Like in Revelation, throw down our crowns. That's before a very him. Good observation, because yeah. It's like that presence or that action of throwing down your crown, casting your crown down, you're acknowledging what? He's king, that if there is a crown on my head, where did it come from?
Gave it to me.
Yes, the Creator gave the crown to you. Crowned you, put the crown on your head. So if you were to say, well, who does it really belong to? The crown belongs to the one who gave it. So thus, when you see also a very interesting picture of David, is that in the one sense you see him, that he took off his normal kingly robes and put on just an ephod and is out there dancing, praising the Lord. But then that's also the message that he gets from the Lord about wanting to build the house. The message comes from through the prophet, hey, I set you up here, I put you in your place, but also see that this is not going to be your work that's going on here. There will be a house, but it's not just because you willed it, you built it, and you put your name on it. It is because this is something that the Lord is accomplishing here. Yes, Anne, you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, well, the other thing then is Michael, his wife there, she was in another world of worldliness and not thinking spiritual thought, you know, that this is a spiritual matter between my husband and my God, you know, and but she didn't seem to have that same understanding of what was actually going on. I mean, lots of times we're kind of blinded to, just like me, I was blinded about the word despise, or she despised her husband for being that way in front of the public, you know, while she's thinking, how can he do this, you know, in front of the, so she's thinking, right, she's, you know, she was, she started thinking, oh, gee, this is awful for me and my family to see this, instead of thinking, this is for the Lord, this is not a realm that I even realize. Like, sometimes we're blinded. We are blinded a lot of times about what's really going on.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, Deborah, you have a comment or a question?
Didn't Messiah do the same exact thing?
You know? Yes, you're talking about like at the...
Well, I mean, he took off everything and became a human.
Yes.
Left his position and lowered himself and came here to interact with his subjects.
Yeah, and then
so,
you,
I mean, I think
and
it
then
looks
you
the
see
same.
It also there at the Pesach when he says he took off his outer garments, put on basically the towel of a servant.
Yeah,
and
twice,
then
yeah.
went to go serve and wash the feet.
Right.
Something that a common servant would do. So that the lesson, and he specifically told his students this, that hey, the Son of Man has come to do what? To serve. So just as the Son of Man comes to serve, thus those who follow, who are part of the kingdom, they also should have that attitude of a servant. Not look for not servant, not greater than his master. That's correct. And so not looking for the best seat at the table of the kingdom of God. If the Lord sticks you in a position, that's the Lord's prerogative. If the Lord moves you down from a higher position, that's also the Lord's prerogative. So should be ready to be promoted and ready to be demoted and take a lesson in both of those situations as they happen. But one of the other things that we get from this particular passage of Shemini, and especially there was in Leviticus chapter 11 when we're looking at the clean and unclean, is that our focus is on what we can control. So there's things that happen with our bodies that just are out of our control. It's a lesson for there are things that we cannot control, happenstances that happen upon us. But if there is something that is within our control, then we should take notice of those things which are fit to approach the presence of God and those that are not fit to approach the presence of God. So Leviticus chapter 11 is like a fast. You talk about fasting. Fasting is about to do what? It is you yourself are having control over what? Your passions, what it is that you want to do. You have control over your impulses. So with this, this is a lifelong fast of a sort because you are fasting from the whole category of things that are said to be not fit to approach. You are fasting from that, and that is what you choose to do. Now, as you see throughout Leviticus chapter 11, it keeps saying, well, okay, if you come in contact with this stuff, carcasses, etc., what do? You treat it like you've been in contact with something that's hazardous. You wash your clothes, wash yourself, and you're unclean until evening. Then you hit the reset button and you start the new day to say, okay, I'm going to avoid that again. That is the goal, is to be watching out for that. But just like we've noted a number of times with the Messiah's parable of the house that had the unclean spirit in it, and they threw the one out, swept the place clean. But then the spirit comes back, says, hey, it's unoccupied. And we've been hearing a lot in the news about squatters. Well, this is the spiritual squatter that just comes in, brings a whole gaggle of other unclean spirits in, and they come in and occupy the place. And it's the punchline of the parable is that the final condition is worse than when you started. So you think, oh, I did a great thing. I had this uncleanness, this thing that's not fit to approach the presence of God, and got it out of my life, but then didn't do anything about it, of filling the vacuum in there. Because one of the things that people always talk about power dynamics in the world, and that's true. People try to dominate. That is the way of the evil world. They try to dominate, subjugate, control. That's why you've seen throughout history, there's one empire or one warlord after another that tries to dominate, conquer people. It's been happening even since, you see, the mighty hunter of the earth, Nimrod. Yes, mighty hunter of people. He was hunting for people to subjugate. One of the first empires that came upon the earth, and people have been looking to dominate since. And you see the description of even the first people on the planet, one looking to dominate over the other. That is a lesson of life. So when we see that there is a force, the force of the adversary is looking to come after us to dominate over us, it's not enough to just say, okay, exclude. So you get rid of this, whatever this presence is that is not fit to approach the kingdom of God, but then you have to do what? You have to fill it yourself, fill your house, so to speak, with something that is fit to approach, the things that are fit to approach. And when you fill your life with that, then there's no longer a vacuum anymore. Yes, the fruits of the Spirit. And we get a lesson from even from our bodies. What is one of the things that you do with the whole movement towards probiotics? What is the point of all that? You have these bacteria that are beneficial, and they're actually stronger than the bad bacteria. So if you have a good population of that you fill your digestive tract with, what happens to the bad bacteria? They get outcompeted. They are killed off, kept in subjugation. They're kept in chains, basically, in your body. Yes. So that's one of those good lessons about filling yourself with the things that are good to crowd out the things that are bad. Yes, Christine, you got a comment or a question there?
Well, I'm just thinking it isn't, I guess I always go back to just the basics. It really is the struggle within me. It's not necessarily outward things coming into me, although not guarding my eyes or my mouth or, you know, my eye gates, what I see can add to the unclean within me, but I have my own, the beastie nature. You hear me refer to it all the time. It's all those desires. Yep. So it isn't so much, I get a little confused. It isn't so much that I'm cleaning out, I'm allowing the Spirit to rule over those bad inclinations, those bad desires. The creativity and all of that is created for a reason. We are in the image of Elohim, but if I let my desire for power or attention or any of that, it can destroy the very good that I have. So sometimes I get confused with that parallel or, yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you know, is a challenge on the planet is that's one of the things that you have in Eastern mysticism is that you have the natural balance that you must take. And even Zoroastrianism incorporated that, where you have the balanced powers, the powers of light and the powers of darkness, and they are balanced and they're necessary to be balanced, to keep you balanced. But that's not the revelation that we have from the Creator. The revelation from the Creator is that balance, so to speak, that's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the good and bad. That's, you know good, you know bad, and that's just a presence that you have in your life. But the rejection of that is saying, okay, it's time to go back to the tree of life, because that's where we started from, to rather than choosing to just be aware of having these things ruling our lives all the time, rather to have the picture of the purge that we have, and that is the Day of Atonement. The lesson that we have in the Day of Atonement is that these things from the tree of knowledge of good and bad, that those things that we have learned about the bad and that we've gone down those paths, that part of us gets covered over and removed. Covered and removed. To just basically acknowledge, hey, this is something that needs to be covered. And then it's also something to remove from us so that, and then it never comes back. But I mean, the thing is that if you have those elements of yourselves that are covered and removed, and then you don't fill that gap or whatever that was in there before, I mean, those folk who have, you might have known, have gone through any sort of recovery programs, what do they keep drilling into you all the time? When you do your spiritual inventory and you discover these things that say, hey, this is part of the chains that have been holding me in one thing or another. What do you do with those things? You just kind of live with them, kind of dust them off, kind of put a nice little hat on them or something like that? No. Those are things that you say, that needs to go. That's part of the list of the things that need to go. Kind of treat this as almost like a hoarding situation. And you need someone to come in and say, I'm sorry, that's got to go. This has got to go. That's got to go. Just clean it out. And sometimes we just need that extra perspective in there. And that's what the instructions of God are like. That's why, you know, the Apostle Yaakov talks about that the Torah is like a mirror, that we see ourselves, but we see ourselves how we actually are, with parallel to what God's standards are. Apostle Paul talks about that in Romans 7, that when we compare ourselves to the law of God, we realize, uh-oh, we don't measure up to this. So those are the things that need to be earmarked to be removed. And that is what the blessing of the new covenant promise is that those things will be covered over and removed. Yes, Tammy's got a comment or a question over there.
Well, going back to this idea of, you know, what do you do when you struggle with your passions and you're removing the things that aren't supposed to be there? If you don't replace it with something good, you leave a power vacuum. So, you know, when Yeshua told the parable, like with the person who had a demon, he had one demon. The demon got thrown out, and he turns around and brings back seven others worse than himself. And since there was nothing in the person filling him, they just came back and made him worse than before. So when we're struggling with our particular passions, or our particular sins, our particular temptations, if we don't replace what we're throwing, casting out of our lives, if we don't replace that with something good and holy, and we leave a hole there, something else is inevitably going to fill that hole. And unless we actively put something in there that's good, chances are the thing that ends up replacing that thing that we've cast off that is bad is also going to be bad.
Yeah. And it's something that we memorialize each time that Pesach comes around. And it's a part of the account of the Exodus. It's not just a metaphor about the army of Egypt chasing after the people. That's just what dominating people do. And dominating people, whether you're talking about the adversary or Pharaoh, that's what dominating people do. They look to exercise power. And when they think that they can dominate over somebody else, they will do it. And Pharaoh got, as you could say in the modern parlance, owned. He got owned during the plagues. I mean, they just one after the other, after the other, after the other. And as we talk about each year when we go through the plagues, it's like, here you have the dominating force is also showing up almost like hat in hand saying, let my people go. But who's got the power here? I mean, Pharaoh is kind of still on the throne, but his throne keeps getting chopped down and chopped down. With each plague that comes along, it's lower and lower and lower and lower and lower and lower amongst down to where the common people are and everybody's suffering, to the last plague, the death of the firstborn of Pharaoh also. He's just like everybody else. He's no longer up on his high throne anymore. He's just suffering just like everybody else is, with a terrible thing, because when you're a king, and you know, some countries' dynasties work differently, but it's almost a universal thing that firstborns is how the dynasties move from one to the next to the next. So for a king to lose the firstborn, you're losing the crown prince. Wow, that is a blow. That is an absolute blow. So when you see another example of where it almost seems like the people of Israel are hat in hand again with their back to the sea, hemmed in on one side and by the other, and with their back to the sea, what would your natural inclination be? I've got power. I can dominate them. I've got this big army with the chariots. I can dominate this force. Where can they go? They're trapped. They have blundered, the most unbelievably strategic blunder ever, by going into an area where you cannot escape. So, what would the human reaction be? I got them. I can go in and just wipe them out or haul them back in chains. But, Creator of heaven and earth steps in. First with a pillar of fire. That should have been a clue. We're back to the plagues again. I'm dealing with something that's way beyond my power. But no, the pillar of fire doesn't dissuade. Because when the pillar of fire lifts and the sea is open, you're thinking, the pillar of fire should have been a clue. The open sea should have been a clue. But just plowed on beyond both of those. And that is really what we face in our struggles that we have every day in life. That's this lesson that we have of Leviticus chapter 11, to separate between the clean and the unclean, is part of a lesson that all of us face. And that heaven is taking each one of us and humanity on a journey to a new beginning, from bondage, from our own Egypt, to rest, thank you, to the land. So that's why you see in the letter to the Hebrews there, where chapter 3 is all about saying, riffing on Psalm 95, I swore my wrath, they will not enter my rest. And going back to those original cases of where you see the people are saying, hey, is the Lord with us or not? Going into the land, oh, the walls are too big. The people are too big. Can't do it. That the same one who took them out of the house of bondage can take them into the land of freedom. No matter how big the walls are, no matter how big the people are, how big their armies are, whatever, they have no problem. Because the one who basically brought the superpower of the time period to its knees could easily deal with the situation. Yeah, and still today. I mean, you know, if you were to think just in the power dynamics, I mean, they would think of one of the U.S. territories suddenly was able to subjugate and bring the United States to its knees, like Guam. We try to dominate Guam, and suddenly, you know, the entire fleet of the U.S. Navy is at the bottom of the ocean. With Guam? And you think that's ridiculous. Well, in a similar sense, you have the people of Israel, parts of Egypt. Their deity says, let them go. What are you going to do? Let them go? You're going to listen to the deity of somebody you think you have power over? Now, doesn't take that hint. that Pharaoh that did not know Yosef. Because we see earlier, we kind of roll the tape back into the life of Abraham, that there was a time period where you had the leaders of even Gaza and Egypt that had some sort of idea of who the Lord was and some sort of idea of decency to realize who it was that they were actually dealing with. Even if Abraham needed to learn how to trust the one that was leading them, those powers eventually got the message and realized who they were dealing with and go, we got to send this guy on his way. We really don't, we're not in the power position here. Yeah, we're in the struggle situation, yes. So that is really what going from bondage to a way of life that leads ultimately to nowhere. Nowhere that lasts, and that's death. So you go from that bondage to a life that leads to death, to rather to one that leads to life, to going into the land. So that's when you see there in Hebrews chapter 3, and it's talking about, I swore my wrath, they will not enter my rest. And then that goes into chapter 4 of Hebrews, which starts talking about, well, there is a rest, a Shabbat rest. That's one of the lessons of Shabbat. As when we see Shabbat, there are many lessons that are packed into one weekly memorial. That's the Lord created. He is the one who created everything. He's also the one that provides you rest. Rest for our restlessness that we have. That we're always trying to fill with one distraction or another. It's one thing or another we try to fill that restlessness with. In today's world, the idea of being in silence for any period of time is... You've probably heard the term silence is deafening. Well, in modern culture, with things barking at us in so many different ways of this and that and the other, that the idea of a silence and entering that rest and being content in the rest, that is something that's foreign to supposedly our sophisticated modern world that's gone beyond the supposedly... machinations and hallucinations of sunstroke goat herders wandering around in the desert, as the caricature is often made of the Torah. Yes, Christine, go ahead.
Silence is even a heavenly pattern and brought up in Revelation and in a few of the prophets too. I've always found that fascinating, calling out for a period of silence. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So, one of the things that we'll kind of take a look at here, just and as we move on and into Leviticus and continue on with this picture of that which is fit to approach versus that which is not fit to approach, the vocabulary that we're dealing with under the hood here in the Hebrew is karban, which we saw in chapter 1. So that's the idea of a gift or an offering, and the root part of that is the thing that is fit to approach. And then you also have kodesh. Now kodesh, that's where we get the term holy from, or it just means separated, and that comes from the verb form of that of kadash, which just means to separate or to distinguish one thing from another. And what you have translated as clean or such is tahor, and unclean is tameh. Tahor and tameh, clean and unclean. So one of the pictures that we have, and one of the passages that we read today is Acts chapter 10. And a reason for taking a look at Acts chapter 10 is that is one of the really, you could say, key passages to show what the purpose of clean and unclean was. That if you didn't get it in going through the book of Vayikra, just how did our passage end today in chapter 11? So you distinguish between what is tahor and what is tameh, what is clean, what is unclean, what is fit to approach the presence of God and what is unfit to approach the presence of God, to teach that there is a distinction between the two of those. There's this idea that's gone into the modern world is that you shouldn't distinguish. You shouldn't distinguish at all. Everything is fine. Everything is fine. Whatever ideas that come in, you just should not say, I shouldn't have that in my life. And we see that when you take a look at some ideas and say, I need to borrow a phrase from the Apostle Paul, take that thought captive. You know, for example, the idea of free reign of use of psychedelic substances. You see, the city of Portland now is reeling from that. They thought, what's going to be the big deal about this? Well, people that could see just the sense of, well, if you're going to give people the ability to just escape, and everybody's into escapism all the time, what do you think is going to happen if you are then promoting it? Promoting it, condoning it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So people just rush headlong into it. And the substances are available now, boy, the chemists have been busy. Is the marijuana now? It's not the marijuana of the 60s and 70s. Nope, it's not that way anymore. The THC levels are way up there. So people are having psychosis from this. And you have the other substances that are coming in, the opiates, etc., that are just not like what people have experienced before. But then you also have a number of the other kinds of situations and conditions are that people just think, oh, there's no real reason to make a distinguish between this is something I should have in my life and something I shouldn't have in my life, until you realize, oh, hey, there's something, the unclean, the tameh spirit has taken over my life and dominated it. I should have seen, this is something that I should have made a distinction. Now, one of the reasons why Acts chapter 10 is also important is that it also emphasizes what tahor and tameh are not about. And that is not about people in the kingdom of God. And that is one of the big lessons of the sheet, that the sheet lifts up, because what do you see? And it just describes them as all kinds of four-footed and crawling, creepy creatures that are within the sheet. Well, you would just say, okay, well, that is all. Then tameh, everything that's in there, I got to just keep away from all of that. But the picture is, okay, that has been lifted up. It has been made a distinction. It has been kadashed from where it was before. It is no longer common, just everything everywhere has been lifted up here. So thus, when you see then the picture and the apostle is reflecting upon this, he's wondering, what on earth is this saying? To take, kill, and eat. And he makes a point and distinction. Hey, I've never eaten anything like this since my youth. I've been following your instructions. I haven't been involved in this since my youth. And the message is what the Lord has made clean, don't call unclean. What the Lord has made tahor, do not call tameh. And then he's wondering what on earth that's all about. And he gets the messenger from Cornelius. So then he gets the inspiration. This is talking about people, that those that are brought into the kingdom are no longer tameh anymore. These are no longer, you're not just picking up your run-of-the-mill Canaanite with their pagan practices anymore. These are folk that are moving away from that. They are, to use a modern parlance term, detoxing from these ways that are apart from God, not fit to approach God. So they are detoxed into the realm of the kingdom of God. So thus, why then do you distinguish them as saying, oh, well, we can't really be together and make a distinction anymore. And that's, you know, we're going through the Paul's letter of Galatians, and that is what the big point was in chapter 2, where he's butting heads with Kepha, with Peter here. He's butting heads with him over this very issue. Because even though Peter got the lesson, and you see the lesson that happened when all of the elders then saw that the Spirit of God was poured out on these who they would normally think these people are tame, they're not fit to approach God, but God approached them and drug them up, called them in, cleaned them off. So when they had been cleaned off, they're like, you are now a part of the same kingdom anymore. So why then are you keeping this distinguishing thing, saying these people are no longer a part of the kingdom anymore? Yes, Christine, got a comment or a question over there.
My understanding is that Cornelius began to attach himself to the God of the God of the Jews.
Yes.
He began to learn their ways, and he was famous for his hesed, and so he began to practice some of their basic things. Of course, he hadn't been circumcised or had the Holy Spirit, but yeah, he was moving away from what he knew before and attaching himself to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yeah, and so one of the things that you see in this, as the chapter 10 closes out, and you see that the Spirit of the Lord comes upon these Gentiles, you're like, oh, well, we got into the kingdom the same way they did. The Spirit came to us, we people who have the front row seat to the Torah and to the kingdom of God, the same way those who came in from the nations do. So why then are we then calling them unclean anymore until they what? Go through our standard to say that they are now part of the kingdom? God has already declared them part of the kingdom. He's given his Spirit upon them as well as upon those that are close in. Now, the one lesson that you see that comes through in a letter like Romans is that, hey, those who have been called in from the nations, do not think yourselves superior over those who've had the front row seat and maybe didn't get it and took a long time to perhaps come around to who the Mashiach was. Now, don't look down upon them. You're all a part of the same body. And then you who've had the front row seat, don't look down upon them. But those who are new to the things of the kingdom of God, realize, hey, there are some things that I have to learn. I got to learn to walk before I start running or sprinting. So that sort of a realization for the new believers to those that are established, or you could say learned believers, that may be new believers as well. They know a lot about the Torah, but they may have to realize the Mark 7 distinction of what is every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God, and then every word that proceeds out of the mouth of some sage. So learn to make that distinction between the two so that you don't blur the lines between them and start confusing the sayings of a sage with the sayings of the creator of heaven and earth between them. So that's hopefully one of the exciting things that we have in a passage like this, where you can just say, oh, it's just a long list of critters on one side and the other. But if you think of this, just like the architecture of the tabernacle is all about teaching, hey, there is a distinction between the world that needs to reconnect with the creator and the creator himself, and that those who are a part of the world out there, okay, you need to start thinking about the things in our own lives that need to be distinguished. the things that are good and the things that are bad, to be able to distinguish between them. And you can see that there are have been a number of cultures that stumbled around in the darkness and groped at some aspects. Like, you know, for example, if you see some of the thought processes and writings of some of the faith systems out there, you'll see, okay, they did hit upon some of these aspects of it. But then there was a lot of aspects that, no, didn't hit quite right because they didn't know where things came from, etc. But the idea is that, okay, rather than groping around in the dark, why don't we just go to the source? Rather than going to the knowledge of good and bad and trying to figure out ourselves, say, okay, well, where is the source of good? So going to the correct source. So you might say going to a second or third hand source, that's the tree of knowledge. Going to the first hand source, that is the tree of life. And that is where you can get your correct view on the world and being able to see the world as it actually is.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.